From KQED and the California Report, this is Capitol Notes, a weekly roundup of California politics from the state capitol in Sacramento.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from TIAA CREF Tuition Financing, managing independent 529 plan, tomorrow's college tuition today, at i529.org/today.
And hello, and welcome to another edition of the Capitol Notes podcast here from our studios across the street from the state capitol. I'm John Myers from KQED, joined as always by my friends in the press corps, Kate Fulmar from the San Jose Mercury News, and Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly. I have to give you the title of editor, Anthony, because you're the biggest management person in this room.
I prefer overlord.
The staff at Capitol Weekly, I'm sure, feels the same way. So we're gathered here to talk about a few of the political stories from this past week. Of course, the day we're recording this is June 15th, Friday, the budget deadline, which will come and go, but we
did we pass a budget?
We did not pass a budget. Kate's been off this week a little bit, so she's just catching up with the news. But no budget, and Anthony and I were trying to figure out the over under on when the budget will be done before we started this, and we're kind of both of the same mind, aren't we?
Late July, mid to late July.
Really?
I'm saying moonwalk anniversary, July 20th.
Oh,
wow!
Interesting. And
that's
you...
that's Neil Armstrong, not Michael Jackson. Moonwalk.
See, now I can't even finish. But your rationale for that date is?
That's the beginning of recess.
Right.
That's the scheduled legislative recess from July 20th to August 20th. And so, you know, that gives the Republicans long enough to hold it up, but not have their staffs be angry that they don't get their vacation. So
we'll see.
Like a reasonable bet.
The budget negotiations really haven't really gotten really off to a big thing quite yet, so we don't have much on that. However, let's do talk about something that happened this week. We had a few interesting people arrive in town. Another one that we don't have on the agenda quite at this moment, but I'll just say quickly, John McCain, Republican presidential candidate, who was in town on Monday, who I went to his news conference here in town, and he, you know, said he'd love to have Governor Schwarzenegger's endorsement, but he doesn't think that the governor will put one out yet, and I don't think any of us think that the governor's going to put one out at this point.
Nah.
Nope.
Those are two no's. But the other person,
you can't shake your head on radio. That's not enough.
It works. No. But the other person in town who certainly stirred up a lot of talk this week was Michael Moore, documentary filmmaker who is in town on Tuesday.
I thought you were going to say Bill Richardson, but I guess not.
That was Bill Richardson in town?
Yeah, was that this week or last week?
I don't know.
Cue the crickets, the producer.
Michael Moore's visit to the state capitol on Tuesday, where he was doing an early sneak preview of his movie on healthcare problems, Sicko. And he did a big event with California nurses. He did a meeting with Fabian Nunez. He did a press conference with Fabian Nunez. He generated lots of chatter in the hallways for a change. The movie star in the hallways wasn't the one with his name over the door down on the other corner. But
he also wasn't tan.
He also wasn't tan. He's from Michigan.
It's, naturally or otherwise.
True that, yes.
But it was interesting to watch the whole dynamic because, I mean, one of the things that I noticed covering this was that he had to walk a very tight line, a bit of a tightrope, I should say, in who he was talking and what he was espousing. He was sitting there with Fabian Nunez in a press conference saying, I really applaud the speaker for getting involved in this issue and moving this issue forward this year. And then in the hearing with Sheila Kuehl, which was kind of a photo op hearing.
Slash said, pep rally. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. In that hearing, he largely said, you know, all of these people who say incremental progress, these politicians, you know, that's not enough. And, you know, was kind of railing against that. That's kind of a back and forth both ways. I mean, he's not a politician, of course, but it was an interesting dynamic to the whole thing.
Well, but doesn't that mirror the debate within the Democratic Party? I mean, really, do you want to try to go for what I think many Democrats think is the ultimate goal, which is universal coverage, some sort of single payer program, or do you want to go for what may possibly be achievable, which is probably something short of that.
Well, certainly the single-payer crowd got a huge boost out of Michael Moore being here. I mean, they got lots of media attention. Right. They really got to state their case over and over. His movie, if you haven't seen the movie, certainly makes the case for single-payer time and time again.
Well, and the flip side of that, too, it's not just Michael Moore walking that tightrope. It's the speaker. I mean, the speaker sees a media opportunity, a way to get front-page coverage up and down the state and TV coverage. By in fact, there was a little bit of a rivalry The original screening of Sicko was scheduled by the California Nurses Association, who are big advocates for single payer. And then the speaker convinced Michael Moore to screen to have another screening. So there were actually two screenings of Sicko here this week. And it was I was joking with some of the nurses' troops in the Capitol. So are you guys going to the single payer screening of Sicko or the compromise screening? But I think that it was sort of mutually beneficial for both of them to get some publicity. Certainly, it was a very effective media tour for the movie and good for the speaker too.
Well, I mean, I think it was. I mean, really, in the final analysis, I mean, there were some people who said, "Oh, Michael Moore's presence is going to change the debate." And I personally felt like, no, it was a great PR moment for him, as much as anything. I mean, there was a question was asked in the press conference was, "How?" You know, one reporter said, "How do you feel? What does it feel? You know, do you feel like you're being used by the California nurses to help promote their issue?" And he said, "No, I think it's the other way around today, isn't it?" And that's really the case. I mean, I think he had a great opportunity to get a lot of headlines. He was on Nightline. He had a crew with following him around from there on that day.
It's like it was France or something. I mean, Michael Moore was just driving him crazy.
Does anyone know if he made any attempt to meet with the governor?
Governor's folks said that they weren't asked.
Really?
So that they weren't asked, and of course they didn't meet. So that would have been an interesting meeting, would it not?
That would have been fabulous.
Well, and Moore, you know, I would say that Moore, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Michael Moore, you know, never having been around him before, certainly knows how the political game works and how the soundbite game works. And he came loaded with a few of them. And one of them that he kept saying, I heard, I think, five times that day, was the governor of this state, you know, was a pretty big, bulky, muscly guy when he came to this country, and he got that body from a universal health care system in Austria. And, you know, and that was one of the lines he used. And again, so, I mean, the governor's name came up a lot, but mm-hmm. but no meeting between the two big titans. But the health care debate, I mean, let's talk just for a moment. I mean, negotiations over health care, they're moving forward. There's discussion going, but there's also a campaign finance issue. Anthony, the Capital Weekly wrote about that this week.
Right. Well, I think that most Capital observers expect the health care stuff to really ramp up after the budget, probably later this summer. In the meantime, the speaker has an initiative out there that would modify the state term limits law and allow him to remain speaker for six more years. And it just so happens that some of the largest players in the health care debate are ponying up big, big bucks for this initiative. The pharmaceutical industry yesterday, earlier this week, gave a $35,000 donation to the initiative. The major labor organization, SEIU, pushed, I think, $100,000 or perhaps more. I think there were a couple of donations. The Hospitals Association, some of the insurers, Blue Cross, they've all given five or six-figure checks to the speaker. Of course, the speaker says there's no connection between these donations and public policy. Of course, I can't imagine why anyone would think there's any connection between political contributions and public policy. But I think it is notable that as this debate heats up inside the Capitol, you know, one of the ways that some of these groups are trying to curry favor with the speaker clearly is through giving money to this term limits initiative.
What an interesting cast of characters all together on that, as you know, pharma and SEIU.
They spent you know, $80-90 million beating each other's brains out in 2005.
Exactly. Over prescription drugs.
Right.
And
exactly.
Pharma, I have to imagine, is still fairly furious with the speaker about, was it last year's prescription drug discount plan that they fought vociferously that the speaker authored and that the governor ultimately signed, although it hasn't been implemented yet.
Well, nothing says forgiveness like $100,000. So it's funny, you know, the prescription drug folks, they're not, at least thus far in the governor's proposal and in the proposals we've seen from the two legislative leaders, there hasn't been a whole lot of talk of prescription drugs, about cost containment or anything like that, something that the state dealt with in 2005 in the run-up to the special election. And there were a flurry of bills that originated in the assembly that passed out that were all vetoed by Governor Schwarzenegger. So I don't know if that's going to emerge as a factor in this, but I would imagine at some point it's going to have to.
How much more negotiation do you think really has to be done or should be done? I mean, really, we're talking about the Democrats negotiating with the governor here, are we not? I mean, because we've largely assumed that legislative Republicans are being put to the side. They're not going to put up votes for anything, mm-hmm. and they don't need the votes under a majority vote bill.
Apparently.
Republicans,
that's the
apparently.
Presumption. Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, how much negotiation has to be done? I mean, how far apart would Democrats and the governor theoretically be? I mean, granted, the governor had all these ideas about money from hospitals and money from doctors, but at the end of the day, you know, they're both pay or play systems in some way.
Right.
Well, I think those are, I think you've identified two of the big sticking points, though, and how you address contributions, if any, from doctors and hospitals. I mean, those are both moneyed, vested, you know, savvy political players, and they both want to make sure that they're not contributing to that system. So,
and how much from business? I think a dollar figure on how much businesses are going to have to put in.
Payroll tax, yeah.
Whether it's not a tax, it's a fee.
Sorry.
And it eliminates the hidden tax.
I forget that.
You're off message, Kate.
tax fee.
But you know, it's somewhere between 4 and 8%.
Seven and a half percent on the Democrats' proposals, right? Exactly. So. And Parada Nunez's proposals.
And Anthony, forgive me because I didn't pick up my copy of Capital Weekly.
You'd be executed after this recording.
From my vacation this week. But what about some of the other players that don't have health in their name, but that are definitely players in this debate? I mean, what about the Chamber of Commerce or the Restaurants Association or some of the business groups? Were any of them throwing money?
Not donating to the speaker.
Term limits?
Yeah, not yet. You know, I guess.
I mean, those are some of the governor's biggest backers, of course.
Sure. And, you know, I don't know where those groups are on the term limits debate. I know that the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce has been pushing a modification of term limits. Mm-hmm. I don't know where the state chamber is. Or,
I have to assume it'll come down in favor.
And you know, this may be premature to draw this conclusion, but what the hey, we're reporters. Why not just jump to any conclusion we want to? But the governor certainly has been raising money at a pretty good clip in his California Recovery Team committee for the last several months, quite frankly. And nobody knows exactly what he's going to do with that money. But again, this gets back to that issue on term limits, I think, about where the governor comes down on the issue and what happens with under the stew of all those other issues is going to be very important because the governor's got a big megaphone and he's going to be sitting on a pile of cash.
And he has the speaker hanging by a thread. There's sort of, you know, the sword of Damocles over Fabian Nunez, you know, depending on which way Schwarzenegger goes on term limits. I think there's a consensus that if term limits is going to pass, if it has any chance of passing at all, that it needs unanimous support from Democrats and Republicans, from high-profile figures like Governor Schwarzenegger and the former Republican governors who have expressed some interest in modifying the law.
Well, let's talk about Governor Schwarzenegger a little bit as a second topic briefly. He had an interesting week. It's another one of those cases events as reporters that you can look at on his schedule that you think, there's not going to really be any news in that event. And then, lo and behold, he says something that takes a turn away from what you think he would say, and all of a sudden he's making some news.
I don't know. I think Schwarzenegger talking to Hispanic journalists is always going to yield some news.
True. Fair enough. But this time he certainly did. So that's the first one. So the governor was in San Jose this week talking to the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. And as he sat down to talk to them, he said something kind of interesting, which certainly made some headlines, which he essentially said, turn off the Spanish media. Stop watching Spanish television if you want to learn English to immigrants from Spanish-speaking countries. And stop reading Spanish newspapers. And that's how I did it when I had to get away from speaking German to speaking English. It was a interesting statement. I don't know. Kate, what do you think? Just on the superficial read of that, what do you make of it, given the governor's past?
Well, I think it's entirely consistent with what the governor has said in the past. I mean, he's an immigrant, and I think that gives him a little more standing on these issues than were you or I to be giving such advice. And he really is a big believer that he's a self-made man, and that, you know, he did this all through his, you know, bootstrap work and coming to the country and learning English and becoming a star and all of those things. And he said before that that, you know, some immigrants from Mexico try to stay Mexican because they're so close to home and that they don't properly assimilate.
So it was a consistent with a theme he's put out there before.
But also a fairly tone-deaf thing to say in front of a bunch of Latino journalists. And not just journalists who are Latino, but also a lot of Spanish language journalists whose market is growing as opposed to the rest of journalism.
Exactly.
So that was a little foolhardy, I suppose. But and also, I just think that he's stepped in it several times on Latino issues and just can't quite manage not to. I mean,
so
he supported the Minutemen border patrollers,
right,
and then said, well, I didn't quite mean it that way, but maybe I did, but maybe I didn't.
So then the question becomes, does this fundamentally change that dynamic? Does it make it any worse? Does it just kind of the same relationship he has with the Latinos and Latino voters and Latino interest groups?
I think it gets him a week of nasty editorials in Spanish. I'm not sure that it has much consequence beyond that. I think there's a, you know, it's the Schwarzenegger-ness about him that this sort of rolls off of him. And I do think Kate's right. The fact that he is an immigrant himself sort of inoculates him from some of this stuff. And it's obviously consistent with
what
he
believes. But there's got to be an upside for him, too. I mean, it resonates with some Californians who still have this conflicted issue on immigration
issues.
Many of
them Republicans.
So, sure.
Yeah.
No, and I think there are a lot of people who are supporters of immigration, who probably support aspects of the president's plan and some sort of amnesty, who don't believe that things like Proposition 187 and demonizing illegal immigrants is a good idea, who also feel that immigrants who come to this country do have some duty to assimilate, and part of that assimilation has to be language. I think you'd find a lot of Democrats who believe that. So it's not like, you know, he was advocating rustling everybody up and shipping them back across the border.
And it should be mentioned that he also, you know, said these comments in the same breath as, you know, praising President Bush and you know, Democratic leaders in the Congress for trying to overhaul the nation's immigration policy and create a pathway to citizenship for, you know, perhaps 12 million undocumented immigrants. So, I mean, he's got kind of nuanced positions.
Well, and I was going to say, in that respect, then, that's classic Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
It's a nuanced, right down the middle kind of thing.
Well, I do think also it's something that voters like about Schwarzenegger, the sense that, look, this is something he believes in. He knew this was going to get him into political trouble. He said as much when he made the statement. And he didn't care. I mean, that's what he believes, and that's what he's going to say. And I think that a lot of people sort of respect that, and that'll help this sort of roll off of him.
Well, speaking of things that he says he believes in and whatever the consequences may be, then on Thursday in this series of town halls, which I have to say with little air quotes around them, I think you used air quotes last week, Kate, but
yes,
because I'm not sure that I would call them town halls the way they're set up, but be that as it may, this town hall in Bakersfield, where the governor expressed support for the longstanding idea of a peripheral canal, which, if you don't follow this issue all the time, let's just say in shorthand, is this longstanding idea that was on the ballot 25 years ago and voters turned down, of building a canal from Northern California waterways through around the Delta, bypassing the Delta, onto the California Aqueduct so you can get water to Southern California. Environmentalists have hated that idea in the past. Agricultural interests, of course, and others and people in Southern California liked it. Mm-hmm. It's been examined again. The governor kind of threw his weight behind it again yesterday, which gets you into this notion of where he might stand on environmental issues and water issues. I don't know. Should we make anything of that?
Yeah, I think that I think we're going to see this. Look, the governor has a proposal for a water bond that would lead to more water storage. And this is it. It's no accident that we tipped 100 degrees here in Sacramento this week, and now the campaign for water storage really begins. We had a very dry year. The snowpack in the Sierra is very, very low, and we're not going to have a drought this year because we've had such wet winters the last couple of years, but we have another winter like we had this year, and we will have a drought. And this is now, the beginning of the campaign for and the beginning of a real discussion about water issues. And, you know, a lot of Democrats have expressed some support for some kind of modified peripheral canal. Joe Simidian, senator from San Jose, Democrat, has a bill that includes some sort of bastardized, I can say that on NPR, right?
You can say it on a podcast.
Okay. version of the peripheral canal. And I think that it's going to be part of the discussion, you know, in the next however many weeks. You know, if I don't know if we're going to get a water bond out of this or not. It's already been voted down once in the legislature, but the conversation's not over.
Well, remains to be seen what will happen on that one. So quickly, a short third topic. It didn't happen in the state capitol, but certainly influences what could happen in the state capitol. And it was big news out of Los Angeles this week about a man who wants to be governor, Antonio Villaraigosa. And big personal news on that front.
Herein known as Antonio Villar.
Yes. Which was his name before he got
there. Yeah, yeah.
If you don't know what we're speaking to, the wife of the mayor of Los Angeles, Mayor Villaraigosa, filed for divorce this week,
right,
citing irreconcilable differences, which I think is what basically everyone cites when,
right,
they go and file those papers at the courts. And Mayor Villaraigosa had this big press conference where he kind of did this whole...
where he didn't say anything.
He held a press conference demanding his privacy.
Yes.
Which was very, very kind of odd. I mean, he put out a written statement last week, could have ended there, and then he came out Monday and said, the public has a right to know, and I'm not answering your questions.
So the big question is, does this, I mean, clearly he is the most talked about candidate for governor in 2010. I mean, hands down. Does this impact it at all or not?
Well, I mean, I think we were talking about this earlier, and I guess it depends on whether or not there is another shoe. The question that people were asking Villaraigosa that he asked for his privacy on was whether or not there had been any infidelity in the relationship, and that's something that he would not answer. And if there were, and I don't know that you know there has been any, but if there were infidelity, you know, that adds into the calculations that voters make when they vote for governor. But of course,
well, and there have been
presumptive rival Gavin Newsom,
right,
of San Francisco,
right,
recently checked himself in for her. I guess didn't check himself in, but sought alcohol, you know, treatment for alcohol abuse, and acknowledged that he had an affair with the wife of a very close aide.
And Newsom was single at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, you know, that comparison with Newsom sort of, and what Kate's talking about with the other shoe, you know, revelations about his personal life led to something I think bigger about Gavin Newsom and you know, just a question of who he was dating and who he was sharing a bed with led to an alcoholism and I think in many eyes diminished his standing as a gubernatorial candidate in 2010. Mm-hmm. Newsom, that is. Now, you know, whether look, marital problems are not have not. This is nothing new for Mayor Villaraigosa. When he was speaker up here, I think he had separated from his wife for a while. You know, I think voters give you a pass on a lot of this stuff, but unless it illustrates something larger about your character.
But certainly a bad few weeks of PR for Mayor Villaraigosa. He had this huge New Yorker piece, which was, don't know how many words it was, but it was a long tome of a piece.
Right.
And it brought back up some of these allegations about his personal life from when he was in the assembly. And it just kind of cascaded, it seemed like, from there. And, I mean, the PR cycle has not been good.
No, but I don't know that marital fidelity is a deciding factor in voters' minds, certainly not in California in the post-Bill Clinton era.
And, I mean, certainly Governor Schwarzenegger was elected despite, you know, allegations reprinted widely by the LA Times and other publications that he had behaved boorishly towards a number of women during his movie career. I mean, I think California voters are fairly forgiving, but it depends whether what the circumstances are and if more of the circumstances of this divorce come out and if they become relevant.
And we're so far out from a gubernatorial race, although it's never too early for pundits to start, you know, musing about what happens with Antonio Villaraigosa, Gavin Newsom. I mean, Jerry Brown's name has come back in for 2010 at this point. I mean, who the heck
knows?
But
we know John Garamendi has no interest in the job.
No,
well,
of
John
not.
Garamendi. And then there was even the issue, and let me just throw this in quickly, of wondering who – there was an account opened that said O'Connell Leadership 2010, referring to Superintendent of Public Instruction Jack O'Connell, that Jack O'Connell did not open.
Right. It's an independent expenditure committee opened on O'Connell's behalf. Now, O'Connell – and it throws – what it does is it injects O'Connell – who's often forgotten in this large field of Democratic wannabes for governor. It injects him into that conversation. We're coming up on a deadline here, July 1st, where before which every campaign committee has to report their filings to the Secretary of State. And so early July, there will be discussions about the 2010 Democratic gubernatorial primary because of some of the committees that have opened. And this committee will inject O'Connell into that conversation. It's yet to be revealed who's behind this committee, but he does have some very wealthy backers in the Silicon Valley, and something tells me they may be playing a role in this.
And he also, O'Connell is a Democrat from the Central Coast of California, and I think ran unopposed, did he not, for re-election?
Well, it was,
this
it was
year.
Largely uncontested.
Or largely uncontested.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who covered him in the state Senate when I worked in San Luis Obispo, I mean, and very much a moderate right down the middle. If you look at some of the issues he's done, he's big on the high school exit exam, which, you know, had its own issues, and very moderate on other issues, but so, all the right social issues. Who knows?
But is a fairly popular, if not, you know, awe-inspiring figure in the Democratic Party.
And speaking of Silicon Valley, I mean, certainly Steve Wesley will come back probably too in 2010. Who knows? It'll be a very busy time
indeed.
All of us.
Yeah. And only 1,000 shopping days left.
So. Get all of that extra
Hello,
work
Angelitas,
in now.
Are you That's listening?
Well, with that, I think we have done as much as we could possibly do on this podcast. I'm sure next week we'll be talking about the budget, and we'll all be watching that, and we'll be back to much more mundane policy issues. But
bring a pillow.
That's enough political prognostication. Bring a pillow. Let's hope we don't have a lock-in this year.
Yes.
Like we did a few years ago when Speaker Herb Wesson locked in the assembly.
Or I remember fondly John Myers and I sitting in the hallway outside of the governor's office over a whole July 4th weekend.
Playing Trivial Pursuit.
With a bunch of reporters. Eating pizza.
Yeah,
waiting for a budget
for the white smoke to appear to get a budget. Yes. Let's not do that again.
And let me tell you, Sacramento on July 4th weekend, beautiful.
Especially if you're not at the river. And something tells me I'm looking into my crystal ball. Compacts next week. Compacts.
Indeed, gaining compacts.
Didn't you say that last week?
Yeah. Okay. And look, we just mentioned it. I was right.
You got to give him credit. Well, that'll do it for Anthony York and Kate Fulmar. I'm John Myers. We'll talk to you next time.